Live from Muscat, this is The Late Show with Krishna Sanal.
Good evening, namaste, and welcome to The Late Show with me, Krishna Sanal. It is 8 p.m. in the UK, 11 p.m. in Muscat, and 5 a.m. in Australia. So good morning, Australia. Hope you have a wonderful Saturday. Tonight, we have two amazing storytellers with us, Vanessa Wolf and Wendy Sher. And we will speak to both of them as soon as they enter the studio.
Live from Muscat, this is The Late Show with Krishna Sanal. Download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TT Radio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Right, so we are just waiting for our guests to enter the studio. I can see that one of them is here. Tonight, we are having a chat about stories. Stories have been said since the time man began sitting around a fire in a cave. Today, we have with us Vanessa Wolf and Wendy Shearer, who are both professional storytellers and are going to talk to us a little bit more about what stories really mean to us as people, how we connect with them, and most importantly, how teachers can make an effective impression on our children through the medium of storytelling. So I'm going to call upon Vanessa Wolf. Vanessa, hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Nice, loud and clear. Thank you, Vanessa. Brilliant. Welcome to Teacher Talk Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for giving us your evening. And our second guest is also here, Wendy. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Teacher Talk Radio, Vanessa and Wendy.
Thank you for having me too.
Thank you. Are you? Is there any sort of disturbance on the sound, Wendy?
Not from my end, no.
Perfect. Just give me one second. I can see someone trying to call in. Right. Okay. I think that should be sorted. Yes. So tonight is all about stories. And I have to say, both of you, while I was doing my research for the show, what you ladies have done with the whole concept of getting a story out is absolutely fantastic. So thank you for the beautiful, beautiful work that you do.
Thank you very much.
Vanessa, I have to start with you. When I first saw your pinned tweet on Twitter, it has a picture of a lot of people sitting around what looks like a forest area with candles in their hands, and you are the center of it all. And that picture is essentially what absolutely caught my attention, and I just couldn't look away. That is what brought me to connecting with you in the first place. So tell us, what has your journey been like? Firstly, tell us a little bit about yourself and your London Dreamtime.
Oh, thank you very much for asking. I really love that photograph too. So I'm a professional storyteller, and I have been for about 12 years now. And what we've been doing is we've been doing storytelling for adults. So as you probably know, storytelling is just as much of an art form for adults as it is for children. And what I like to do is I like to find beautiful, secret, tucked away or hidden away corners of London. And then I invite a group of people to come and join me. And we all get out our blankets, and then we all light little candles in a jar. And then I'll tell them different stories. And often I'll tell them folk tales or myths or legends that are somehow connected with the local area. And sometimes they're really magical and fantastical, and sometimes they're just quite scary, or sometimes they're funny. It's been a really beautiful thing to do over the last, I guess, 12 years now.
That's a very long time, Vanessa.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And yourself, Wendy?
Yes. Well, I spend a lot of my time storytelling in school, and mostly primary school, sometimes secondary school. And I also get invited to tell stories across art institutions, museums, heritage places, usually and festivals, and often I get asked to tell African and Caribbean folk tales, or if it's to go alongside an exhibition. Like recently, I was asked to do some of Chaucer's tales from the Canterbury Tales to go alongside Thomas Becket exhibition, and then I will take that story and research it and adapt it and make it ready for the
Wendy. I'm sorry Hello? To cut you off there. Yes, could you hold the microphone a bit closer, because you're cutting off in between.
Oh, how's this now? Is that better?
Yes, definitely
okay.
Better.
Great. I don't know what you quite heard up to, but I think I was just saying that I will take these stories and research them and adapt them and make them my own and ready for the audience that I'm going to be telling.
Yes. And Mandy, I also know that you are an author, and more importantly, you've also produced children's television.
Yes, that's right. I actually started my career in children's television in the 90s. I started out as a researcher on Nickelodeon in New York, and then I spent years at the BBC working on GCSE Bite Size, and then Children's BBC as a live producer and digital producer on children's programmes mainly, before I left broadcasting and moved into digital at Kew Gardens.
Lovely. So of all the different things that you've done, which did you enjoy the most?
Oh, that's a tough question.
That's a controversial question.
That is a controversial question. I mean, I was quite I was in my 20s when I was doing television. I'm a mum of two now, two young girls. So back then, that was right for me. But I think the one common theme throughout all of my roles and all of my jobs was I think writing and researching and creating stories for our audience. So whether it was for television or website, and recently, as you've mentioned, I've written my first children's book. I think I've always had that passion for sharing stories. So I've loved all of my jobs. I love the most what I'm doing now.
Lovely. Now, since we're talking about stories, what actually qualifies as a story for a professional storyteller, Wendy?
I think a story is a narrative, an account of a series of events, and it could be real or fictional or a mixture of both. It could be told through prose or verse, and there has to be, I think, what we call it, that journey that you take the audience on. So there's usually that basic template for a story, which has to have the beginning and the middle and an end. And within that, the storyteller will look at a few basic elements, like the landscape, the setting, the characters, the plot. There's got to be some conflict. Well, not got to be, but there usually is. And of course, the resolution towards the end, unless you're leaving people on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, pretty much what we would teach children when we are asking them to write a story, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Vanessa, is that the exact same description for you? What qualifies as a story?
I was thinking about this. So there is definitely a community of storytellers that Wendy and I are both part of. And within that community, it's considered that, you know, a proper storyteller will tell traditional material. So that's stories that have been passed down orally through the generations. So whether this is stories from different countries, you might get, I don't know, Chinese folk tales, or you might get Greek myths, or you might get legends like the legend of Robin Hood or something like that. But it's all traditional folkloric or legendary material. And there is definitely a feeling that those are the proper stories, and those are what a storyteller ought to be telling.
Yeah.
They're very powerful stories, and they're also very fun, and they're really easy to connect with people because they're so human and they've been told for a long time. However, I also think that it's really important to tell true stories and amazing stories from history, and stories that are new as well. And also to encourage children, if you're going to a school, it's great to encourage children to join in making up the story or make up their own stories.
Right. Now, stories we have always been introduced to as something that we grew up with, so it's probably a bedtime story, something that probably our grandparents tell us. How did that become a profession?
It's very different being a professional storyteller than it is telling your beloved one a bedtime story. Although I think, and I'm sure Wendy would agree with me about this, that the sort of basic reality is the same, that you're still trying to take somebody else on a journey and you're trying to enchant them and help them to fall into another world or be part of a different place. But right. When you're a professional storyteller, there are so many more things to think about. So as Wendy does a lot of work in schools, and she does amazing work in like museums and galleries and all kinds of wonderful arts organizations. And I do those kinds of things too sometimes. And if you're going to be working with, let's say doctors, for example, let's say you're doing a presentation, a storytelling presentation to consultants, you're going to be wanting to deliver something that's completely different than you would if you were going to a session for under fives. And so as a professional storyteller, you need to be able to walk into any audience, whether it's 1,000 people in an auditorium or 2 people sitting on a beanbag on the floor, and you need to be able to give them exactly what they need.
Right. And are these things...
That's a bit different. Sorry.
Sorry, that's fine. So, Wendy, coming back to, you know, the difference between a professional storyteller and telling stories to your loved ones, is your take the exact same thing?
Yes, and I think as well that a professional storyteller would have practice and rehearse and really thought about the skills that they want to bring across when you're engaging an audience and what scene that you want to set for that specific type of story or storytelling that you're doing. But it's very tailored.
Wendy, you're cutting off again.
Hello, it's very tailored. Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, it's very tailored. So you're trying to connect with every single person that's in the room with you and make it a collaborative experience. It's not a passive experience when you're storytelling as a professional storyteller. I mean, each one of us has our own unique way of doing it, but I personally like to try to make everyone feel that they can participate in the story. So they're not just, you know, they're not perhaps, it's not the same as, say, watching a play.
How important is magic to storytelling, Vanessa?
Oh, it's a really interesting word, the word magic, because that's what people associate with the idea of storytelling. So people always say that it's enchanting or that it's spellbinding or things like that. And definitely there is a sort of a way that stories take you into another place that to me really does feel magical. I'm really, really interested in the sort of magical power of storytelling to help you change the way that you see the world, to help you think about things in a different way, and to inspire you and encourage you and just basically change your thinking.
Right. Wendy, you've written stories and you've done work around Greek legends and myths and the African Caribbean folktales. So yes. Is magic a major feature in your work?
I think magic is a feature, and in the sense that blending or blurring the lines between the otherworldly and being able to encourage people to let their imagination run free within the story. So I think definitely a common thread between them all is that there might be a grain of truth or some historical facts within the stories that you're telling, but you are in trying to inspire people or challenge them with the tale.
Right. Okay, yeah, so things around us do carry a lot more meaning, and then stories help provide a bit of light, isn't it? So, the thing is, every single one of us has a story in terms of our lives, in terms of the things that we do, in terms of what it is that we want to convey. So when we go into a thing like a job interview, we're basically trying to sell our story. and that's what the person receives. Things, even the objects around us, like a building, a car, or even a bridge, and like when we know, get to know how it came into existence, that is probably what remains with us. So in the whole process, as professional storytellers, the amount of research that you have to do, how time-consuming is it to be able to put a story across? What's the back, the what should I call it, the behind-the-curtain amount of work that you have to do?
I'll answer this quickly.
Okay.
And then Wendy can answer hers. I'm in the middle of devising a new story, which is I'm going to be telling in December, and it is a huge, huge, huge amount of work. And in fact, I'm starting to wonder whether I've not bitten off more than I can chew, all the different research, all the different things. But on the other hand, sometimes I can just pick up a story, maybe I hear it or read it, and then just tell it the next day if it feels like it's right for the occasion. So sometimes, I guess my answer is occasionally it's really easy, but generally speaking, I think it's a lot of work.
I would agree with that as well. Absolutely. I think, well, in the sense that it's enjoyable work, but I think, you know, we're dedicated to bringing as much of the story or finding out as much of the story before we tell our version of it, whether it's a straight retelling or an adaptation. So I would often try and find the original version as much as possible as I can of a story or different other ways it's been told, and then it's a process that you go through to make it relevant to the audience that you're about to tell it to.
Right. And this research, does that involve a lot of travel?
Sometimes it can. I think Vanessa, you tell mostly a lot in quite a lot in real different places, different venues, and I know from some of Vanessa's photos that she does a lot of recces, which is fantastic for her stories. For myself, I'm usually sometimes in a venue that's there all the time. So, but I would be given research, or if it's a topic from the school, they might be telling me about what they're studying, and I'll make sure that I have communicated with the teachers about that. Or if it's an exhibition, I was just recently asked to do something for Hampton Court and spooky stories coming from Halloween. So. Sometimes there's quite a lot of lead-up time needed to get all that behind you before you start actually adapting the story.
Right. Just a quick word to our listeners. Thank you for logging in and tuning into The Late Show. You are listening to Teachers Talk Radio, and we are talking to two professional storytellers, Vanessa and Wendy. Please do type in your thoughts and questions into the chat. And please do feel free to call in. We would love to be able to listen to you, and so will our guests. Talking about locations, I've noticed, Wendy and Vanessa, that Vanessa's are quite different, actually. Vanessa, your locations are generally derelict buildings, ancient chapels, and I believe you've even done one or two in a cemetery.
Yes, I have. It's not just for adults. So we've done also taken schools on local history walks around the local area. So you take them to a place nearby that might have a story attached to it, and you can tell children the story of the local area. And it really brings it to life when you're actually looking at, the place where the story happened. I think the strangest place that I've ever told a story was a commission that I had from the Cooming Museum, which is a museum in Southwark. And they wanted a storytelling to go with their exhibition, and it had to be about the theme of coming home. And they requested that I do a storytelling walk through Elephant and Castle Roundabout. So Elephant and Castle at the time was one of the biggest roundabouts in London, and very, very heavy traffic there. A big kind of supermarket on one corner, a pub and some shops and things, lots and lots of buses. And it had these underpasses that people used to go and wee in them. And I mean, it was really, really horrible. And they wanted to have a story walk there. And it was actually one of the most, it was really amazing. We told the story of Odysseus going home, the Greek myth of Odysseus.
Hi.
And when we went down into the underpasses, we pretended that we were going into the underworld, the world of the dead. And it was actually surprisingly convincing. And so it really is wonderful that you can also creatively use your environment to make the story more gripping, immersive.
Right. It's a complete experience, isn't it? It's a social experience there.
Yeah.
Nice. Wendy, you've done something similar too. I read about the storytelling you did on the Tower Bridge with the glass floor.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. And but what was quite challenging is that I think I was telling to under five. And
yeah.
So they wanted me to use the venue, this new floor that they put in at the time, which was completely transparent and looked down into the river and the bridge below. They wanted me to kind of bring that into the story and the history of Tower Bridge into the story for very young children. And so I managed to select a series of nursery rhymes and songs and actions whilst telling them the story of how the bridge was first developed and how we used the river right from the 18th century to today. So it was fantastic being able to do that, and then they could actually look and see and use their imagination to think about how it was.
Yes, I was looking through some of those pictures, Wendy, and I had to ask, did they not realise that they were the kind of height they were at, the little ones? Was it, did that freak the parents out? Because I was spooked out just by looking at the video.
Oh, they loved it. They had no fear. The parents were a little bit spooked out. They jumped around the edge, and the children, we had some building blocks, a few props as well. So we built bridges, and they just completely went with it. They used their imagination and loved it. But yeah, the parents, that they were a little bit more nervous about being that high up.
Of course, and that's understandable. So since you are both fans of not so regular locations when it comes to storytelling, would you encourage teachers to do their bits of storytelling outside of the classroom, find a different venue?
Oh yes, I definitely would. I think it would inspire the children around them and perhaps even make it more relaxing for the teachers to not worry about needing to have the book and follow the words on a book, but to let everyone use their senses, all of their senses, as many senses as they can whilst they're outside.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that something that can be quite fun is if you get the children to use parts of the school environment to act out the story. So, for example, if you were doing something like the Three Billy Goats Gruff, and they've all got a bridge to cross or something, you don't have to have an actual river in your school. You can just use a path, perhaps, with grass on either side of it, and you can get the children to pretend to be the billy goats crossing the bridge and things like
that.
Nice. So, you know, if you just think a little bit creatively about your school environment, use a part of the playground or maybe a bit, even just a bit of the hall, and set it up like parts of the story, it's amazing how immersed the children can get in it, and they almost believe that they were really, you know, on a crossing over a rickety rackety bridge.
Yes, absolutely. From your experiences, have you found that it's easier to engage the younger students as compared to the older ones?
I think when I first started off, I thought it would be, I found it more terrifying to tell in front of adults, actually, and when I spoke to adults, other storytellers, they found it more terrifying, some of them, to tell with children, because children are brutal, aren't they? They don't hide what they think or how they feel about what they're doing. And whereas I think as adults, when I was first telling in front of adults, and we're quite poker faced, so as an audience, we don't usually show our expressions, so I find it really hard to read. But I've grown used to that and realised actually that's not a sign of how much I'm enjoying the story. So I don't mind what age. I think I love actually multi-generational storytelling. If you've got an audience with babies and grandparents, trying to reach them all and getting them all joining in that collective experience. experience for me personally is a joy.
Vanessa?
Yes, I feel like Wendy does, that all ages are great. When I was starting storytelling, the audiences that scared me the most were teenagers. And I thought, oh, teenagers, they're going to be too cool, and they're just going to think that it's not fun and things like that. And now teenagers are my favorite audience. I mean, I really love all ages, but I think teenagers, year 7, year 8, year 9 is so fun because they're just so sparky and they've got so many ideas, and they're able to express themselves in a more complex way as well, so they can understand really quite sophisticated stuff, and it's really fun. I love it.
Television, for example, is a very visual storytelling medium. And there's a reason why when we watch a movie, we tend to remember pretty much everything, including some lines that really stay with us afterwards. Sometimes, at least I found this personally, that I'm affected at an emotional level, and then I brood over it, I think about that a long time after the whole movie is over. So when you are telling a story, especially when you do things, scary ones, do you issue a sort of a disclaimer to draw the line between, or to make it really clear that this is fiction, and to warn the listener at some level, Vanessa?
Yes, so I do quite a lot of, because I work with adults a lot, I do quite a lot of scary storytelling, and there's a real difference between, some people want it to be really, really scary, and they really want to feel scared, and they're the sort of people who would go to, the Babadook or something at the cinema. And then there are people who really don't want to be scared. And then, of course, there are people who have personally experienced all kinds of things that aren't very nice in their own lives. And I've got no idea who is going to be listening and what they are going to have gone through. So if you're going to the cinema, then usually you can read a little review of the film. You can go, oh, this has got infant mortality in it, a baby dies in it. I feel sensitive about that, so I'm not going to go to that if you're going to a film. But if you're going to a storytelling, you could have, stories have all kinds of awful things in it, and you are absolutely right to say they affect you very strongly emotionally. And so I always try and be very unambiguous about what kind of level of scariness people can expect, or if there's anything, I don't know, if it might be a bit naughty, it might be a bit rude or something like that, then I'll make sure that everybody knows that that's what it's going to be. In the same way that also, if it's going to be very long, I'm going to let people know as well, so that they can kind of get themselves ready in their head to be really responsive to what's going to happen. And then they are relaxed because they know what's coming, and I'm relaxed because I know that everybody's ready to hear it.
Right. Wendy, are you a fan of scary stories?
Not quite perhaps as much as Vanessa. She's very hardened, and I've listened to some of her scary stories where I've been totally shocked in the middle of it all. But I do agree that if possible, I definitely try to let people know in advance if there is a story that I think might have some strong themes within it that might trigger some emotions or personal memories. And sometimes I've been asked to, well, recently I was asked to tell a story for a group of grieving mothers, and it was a support group. And I was really challenged as to wanting to tell something that I thought that they could relate to, but at the same time I didn't want everybody to, I didn't want to upset people even more, but they wanted some stories that would kind of encourage them all to discuss and heal, help them to heal, which obviously storytelling has the power to do. So that was really moving for me as well, doing that.
Of course. What's the most terrifying response you've had to a scary story, Vanessa?
Me?
Yeah.
Someone burst into tears and ran out of the room, and then peeped around the door, and then they came back for the second half. But I was a little bit shocked. That was actually my fault. So that was a few years ago, and it was a story that I'd never told before, which I had got ready for a ship. There was a Victorian ship in Greenwich, and they wanted to have a night of spooky stories called Dark River. So I had this spooky story, and I'd never told it before, and I'd especially designed it for the ship. And as I was telling it in public for the first time, my husband goes, "That was absolutely terrifying. Did you see that person run out and be really scared?" And I was like, "Oh no." And so that was, I guess, a point where I learned something, because I realized that, you know, I need to get someone to listen to if I'm doing something scary. I judged it as being kind of medium scary, and actually it was hot scary. Luckily they didn't mind, so luckily they came up to me afterwards and they said that that it was cool. But I learned that I have to get somebody whose judgment is really good to listen through to the scary ones, just so that I can make sure that I'm always judging it exactly right.
Right. I noticed on your website that you have a couple of scary things planned for the Halloween month, for October. Yes. And I signed up to your vampire one.
Oh, great.
The online one.
Yes.
Oh, and you're making me think twice. So is there some sort of a disclaimer you want to issue for that one?
That one, although it's a very dark story, it's a wonderful old Russian story, but it's not especially scary. And particularly because we're going to be doing drawing. So there'll be an artist there as well who'll help you to draw some pictures. And while you're drawing the pictures, I think it will help you to understand the beauty of the story rather than going in on quite how terrified you are.
Thank you for sharing that. The faint-hearted like me will be much relieved. Wendy, any experiences from scary stories?
I have, but not quite as vivid as Vanessa's, and not quite leaving the room, which is brilliant. I have seen, especially in the last few months whilst we've had to do storytelling online more, whilst you can see everybody really close up, I've been telling a scary story. I think it was a Trinidadian folk tale about a sea serpent, and he rips she's punishing someone, and she basically rips him to pieces and throws his pieces of his body all over the island. But seeing collectively people's face or clutching their face at the time, and I wasn't quite expecting that, and having it so close was a little bit alarming. And I suddenly thought afterwards, well, maybe I should have an alternative version for that as well, just to judge the room and see what people are really up for.
Nice. Do you think that this whole scariness, or this feedback that you do receive, whether it's scary or whatever the theme of the story is, it has got a lot to do with the way you present it? So it may not really be the story itself, but just the way you choose to tell it, isn't it? In terms of expression and volume and music. Vanessa, so what's your role? Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So what we do is, as we're telling the story, we're always looking at the audience and trying to work out for example, the big one is if they're starting to get bored. So, you know, the minute you see the first signs of the audience starting to lose interest and lose that kind of fix it on the edge of their seatness that you want them to have, then you will try and do things to make it more exciting, more interesting. So sometimes you just go, you know what, I'm just going to cut out this whole bit where she goes through the forest, and I'm just going to get straight to the bit where she arrives at the house. Or you might go, maybe I'll drop my voice and start talking a little more quietly to bring out some of the menace. Or you might think, perhaps I'll describe a little bit of the beauty of the forest to bring out the wonder. Maybe I'll add in a talking spider or something like that. And you do this almost instinctively after you've done a few storytellings, of just looking at the audience and seeing how they are,
right,
and changing and judging your story in the moment And that's one of the beauties of live storytelling as opposed to a lot of other performance arts. That's one of the things that storytelling really is different.
Right. We have a comment. We have someone joining us. And this is he says, I'm a teacher of mathematics and biology. I am Nyabizi Tieneste from Rwanda. I hope I've said your name rightly there. Apologies if I haven't. Thank you for joining us. Please, if you do have a question for our storytellers, please do type it in or feel free to call us. Wendy, we were just talking about our responses to and the whole experience of that we bring in. As teachers, when we do storytelling, we try and do it at a very minimal pace so that our students really grasp it. But teachers also have a hidden motive. It's not just always about giving them an enjoyable experience. We're also focusing on language. We're focusing on making sure that we're introducing those words that they need to get in. We're trying and getting them to pay attention to intonation. So how important, or more importantly, how effective do you think it is to have a different motive apart from just enjoying it? Basically, should cognitive ability and cognitive impact be something that teachers should think about when they're storytelling?
I think it is important, but I think it's also important to remember that children, you don't want to just have a narrow focus, and because whilst children are enjoying the story and listening to the story and engaging in it, they are picking up those language skills. They are listening to your huge vocabulary, and that's part of, simultaneously they're developing all of those skills with their grammar and while stimulating their imagination, and I think that is key, because you don't want to take away from the joy of them wanting to either read or hear a story without a purpose. I think they're all important.
Yes, I would add to that to say that, I'll tell you a little story. One time I was invited to a multilingual European storytelling festival in Italy, and I only speak English. Okay. And they had a French storyteller telling stories to Italian children. And so he was telling his story in French with occasional words of Italian and one or two words of English. And yet I found I was able to follow and understand the story, and I was gripped within it. And I realized that what was happening was I was being taken kind of beyond my language skills. So although I have very little French and very little Italian, the few words that I could understand meant that I was understanding the story. And I realized that all I needed to do was to just keep on listening to this person, and my language skills were just going to go up and up and up. And that's right. What happens when you tell a story. When I'm telling a story to 3 and 4 year olds, I'm telling perhaps quite a sophisticated story using language that they would not use themselves yet. But because I'm using props, I'm using my face, I'm using actions, maybe I've got an illustration for them, they're able to follow it. And because human beings love stories so much, and we're built to sort of follow stories, even very small children can understand quite complicated stories. And that's where they grow. And because they're motivated, because they're enjoying it, they are learning much more than they would do if you just sat them down with a list of words and said, okay, now repeat this after me.
Absolutely. And I think I'd also just add in the fact that it's, as we've said a little bit earlier, that it's a participatory experience with the children. So they're not just listening to us telling a story. You know, we're prompting them for their ideas. I will ask them, what do they think? What would they like to have in the story? What food would you like to have in the story? What do you think this character would look like, or what can you hear? And so they are speaking and joining in, and in that way, I always let children know that they're helping me create the story. We're bringing the story to life.
Mm. Yeah. You've used a lot of multisensory props during sessions, both of you. And I've noticed that, Vanessa, with you, you created some beautiful props for the story of the Great Fire of London.
Yes.
So, yes, how does that work? Do you because I noticed that you made some of them yourself, so that's an additional task for your already huge job. So how does that work? Talk us through that.
Okay, so the Great Fire of London was a commission from the Museum of London, and they wanted a new story to tell about one of the biggest kind of things that ever happened to London, which was the Great Fire in 1666. And they wanted it particularly to be able to share with schools, for special schools, so that's for children with special educational needs or yeah. learning difficulties, and thus they said, please have multi-sensory props. And so I came up and devised with all kinds of things from, I made gingerbread to an old recipe because nice. The character in it, she ends up selling gingerbread to make a living. And I also cut out pieces of leather to be like, that you would make into a shoe so that people could touch them and feel them and pass them around and we did all kinds of things to smell, things to taste, things to touch, things to put over your body, things to try on, all kinds of things. But the important thing is that although we did it for special schools, mm-hmm. those props are just as useful when you are in a mainstream school. And also, even I have used similar kinds of props with storytelling for adults. I don't do it all the time, but everybody likes a bit of multi-sensory props. Maybe they like some herbs to smell that will conjure up the atmosphere or that are relevant to the story. Maybe a fruit or something like that. They might like to eat it or try it or touch it. It's amazing how it can root you. A sensory experience can root you in the story in all kinds of ways.
Lovely. Wendy, you've used some of them yourself too. And with reference to your stories, because they come from a very different world, because I know that you like to do a lot of African, Caribbean based stories. So are they easier to create, harder to create?
No, I think it's about the same. And also sometimes I blend or I've been asked to tell stories from European countries and Caribbean at the same time. I recently, in fact, I think next weekend I've got another workshop coming up at the British Library, and I've been telling Paddington Bear stories. And
yeah.
Paddington Bear originates from Peru in South America, and so they asked me to create some sensory props because a special needs group was coming in to the exhibition, and it was a tailored session for them. And so I was telling them, adapting some Paddington stories, but starting with some South American stories. And so we got feathers, and I began the story in a rainforest, and everyone had some feathers passed around, and they were imagining different types of birds. We had some sounds and bird calls, and later on I used similar props for a different group, an older class of children, older age group of children that came in. And so, as Vanessa said, we can use the props for all ages at times, just thinking about in which way and how it would work within the story. But one thing that is a little bit different is sometimes I bring in percussion instruments that are specifically from parts of Africa or South America, and I let the children know that. And I'm not a drummer. I wish I was, because I love it when I see African drumming. doing that. That's not a skill that I have, but I will either bring in some recorded music, or I'll bring in some percussion, some djembes and gourds, and sometimes schools will have them, and we'll all use them together. I'll let them know where they're from, and it's fantastic because you've got the visual experience, they've got the music,
the audio experience.
Yes, yeah. It's really great.
Lovely, a complete experience right there. The more I listen to the two of you, the more I am in awe of what you do. because I would not have imagined this to be something that's so laborious. The amount of work that you are having to do, right from getting the story, researching it, prepping, and then what I find most fascinating here is, Vanessa, what you said about judging how the audience are reacting and then making an on-the-spot decision about which parts to include. Now, that's you using your brain in three different ways all at the same time. Here you are trying to present and perform, which is quite a task in itself. And at the same time, you're trying to respond and decide which bits to keep and not to keep based on your understanding of how the audience are reacting. Does it ever get too much?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, it's funny you should say that, but although I've made it sound kind of impossible, it's something that I think all storytellers do to a certain extent. So obviously, Wendy or me or someone who's been doing it kind of professionally for a long time will do it will be more aware of what we're doing. However, if you imagine yourself telling a friend about something that happened to you in the car park and you see your friend kind of drifting off, then you probably would edit yourself a little bit. You'd think, oh, she's got to go in a minute. I'll just get to the good bit. And you'll just do it yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it is kind of, it's a kind of natural part of storytelling. It's a little more, I guess it's a little more difficult when you're doing kind of a big presentation, but it's ultimately that same skill.
Right. Just the way you've put it there, that's made it so much simpler to understand. We have a comment here from Nabezi, who we just spoke to a few minutes ago. He says, it is very good to tell histories to the students when you are teaching maths and science, because it is a way of making effective learning to the students and a way of motivating students. Thank you for that comment. Yeah,
absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that. So some people think that storytelling is only for, perhaps literacy in the curriculum, right, or maybe they might go, and perhaps history. But really, storytelling can be used, definitely can be used in science. So there are things like, the story of how... one of the stories that I find amazing is the story of Michael Collins, who was the man who went to the moon with Neil Armstrong, mm-hmm. but never actually got to walk on the moon. And I've read his book about how he went from a boy, basically, to that moment of being in the control capsule. And it got me so interested in the science behind it. You can hear stories of amazing discoveries. You can hear kind of key moments like the moment of the discovery of the double helix or something like that. And then there are also stories that you use to do with maths. So there's a story I can think of, which is all about this man who was asked to have a certain amount of money as swapped to a certain amount of rice. And I think what he said was, you'll put one grain of rice on the first square of a chessboard, two grains of rice on the second square, four grains of rice on the third square, eight grains of rice on the fourth square, and so on. And the person who was hearing this thought, that's not very many grains of rice. Yeah, sure, I'll give them the rice instead of the money. And ended up being bankrupted because they had so much rice that it, kind of covered the whole country. And it's a really, really great way of kind of understanding how numbers work.
Right. Definitely. Vanessa, are you aware that story that you've just said actually comes from an Indian a legend of the gods?
I did not, but I have heard it told in various different ways.
Right.
And so that sounds like that's probably maybe one of the original early sources.
Yeah, my grandmother and my great-grandmother did tell me that story. And it's about how one of the gods was so proud of everything that he had that he decided, that's basically how it goes. But he thought, and it's a fascinating one. Thank you. You've just brought back a lot of memories there.
Oh, that's great.
We are now going to quickly, oh, I've got one more comment that says, also, improvisation in science makes learners more effective and to be stimulated in the lesson. Absolutely. Stories can have so many important effects on us. We are at a time when we need to take a quick break. So I'm going to play the news and our adverts. And when we come back, we're going to listen to a story from both Wendy and Vanessa. So I hope you are ready for that, ladies, because I am absolutely excited. Right, so let's get going.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins-Burke. This is Tom Hopkins-Burke with a Teachers Talk Radio News special. Gavin Williamson has lost his job as Secretary of State for Education as part of a wider government reshuffle. Williamson, who had served as Education Secretary since 2019, has been criticised for his handling of schools and exams during the pandemic. Williamson tweeted he was particularly proud of transformational reforms in post-16 education, in further education colleges, skills agenda, apprenticeships and more. Boris Johnson said last week that Williamson had done a heroic job of dealing with very difficult circumstances. Reaction to Gavin Williamson's departure as Education Secretary has been overwhelmingly positive. Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green claimed that Williamson has failed children and young people, their parents and our hard-working education staff during the pandemic. Sam Friedman, former Department for Education Special Advisor under Michael Gove, said that Williamson was by some distance the worst education secretary in history. And a statement from a university and college union representing further and higher education workers said... Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique, challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors, and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles, and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website, www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TTRADIO. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programs to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom.
Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com. Need support with your phonics
teacher below, and because you never know what you're...
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programs to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics. Floppy more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics.
Right, thank you. Welcome back. You are listening to The Late Show with me, Krishna Sanal, and we have with us Vanessa and Wendy, both professional storytellers, and they are talking to us about their amazing, amazing job and how we as teachers can use some of those storytelling skills in our own classrooms. So coming back to both of you, welcome back. Hope that was not too long. I have to ask, how have stories evolved from ancient times? Vanessa, I know that you've done quite a bit of research into ancient stories, especially the Disney ones.
Yes. It's interesting. So, of course, our stories have changed. But what's mostly changed about them is the things that have changed about society. So it's more the content of the stories. It's talking about things that perhaps don't exist so much anymore. However, you just gave me an example earlier in the program about the story with the Indian gods and the pieces of rice on the chessboard, which is obviously a very, very old story, which is still just as powerful and relevant today as it was, you know, maybe thousands of years ago. So some stories are, even though they're talking about things that are very long ago and things that may be ways of being and ways of living that feel very remote to us in our modern lives, they can still be relevant and important. And some of my favorite stories are stories that are very old. Were you wanting to know about some of our fairy tales, which are...
That would be interesting, Vanessa. Go for it.
Yes, that's right. They are very, very old. So there was some research done in 2016, which used linguistic models to look at the kinds of language that was used in different versions of fairy tales. So they took fairy tales like Jack and the Beanstalk and Cinderella, and they looked at different versions that have been told, and they discovered that some of these stories are really, really old. So you might think something like Jack and the Beanstalk is maybe a few hundred years old, maybe it comes from, I don't know, Tudor times or medieval times or something like that, but they say that it is thousands of years old. So the oldest one that they found was a story called The Smith and the Devil, which is a very well-told story. I told it myself for adults only a few months ago. And they say that that is probably 5,000 years old, which is
wow,
an absolutely enormous amount of time. It's hard to conceive of how long ago 5,000 years was.
Wow. 5,000 years, that's ancient.
Yeah, really, really ancient. Yeah, you know, ancient. We were so different. And yet, the story somehow has survived all those different retellings and still feels relevant enough for us to want to tell it and listen to it today.
Yeah. Talking about adaptation, we know that, because I did this for my school once, and we found out that the stories, the Disney versions of them are really dumbed down to make it all pretty and make it appealing to little ones, and especially to create that visual experience. And even the simple story of Cinderella actually involved blood and brutality. So coming to how stories have evolved, one of the common features that we find in our stories is that the stories that were said earlier are the ones that we are most familiar with, maybe due to the audiovisual experience, is that there's always a damsel in distress and there's a prince that comes to save her. Of late, that's been changing. So we have creations like Brave and we have Pocahontas and we have women who are standing up for themselves. Do you feel that stories, as storytellers, you are in a position of power where you can alter that perception? You can create a different version of it in order to appeal to the requirement for the society at the moment?
Is that a question for...
For you, Vanessa. We'll start with you and then we'll go to you.
That is an extremely interesting question because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's considered to be that storytelling as a profession, we should be dealing with traditional material. So material that's maybe hundreds or, as I said, even thousands of years old. So it comes from a society which is old. And, you know, we've changed a lot of the way that we think now. And things like, a thousand years ago, the idea of slavery or the idea of serfdom was considered to be just a simple fact of life. And, you know, everybody would have that and it wasn't really a big deal. And so if you look at stories from those days, then they're going to, you know, perhaps they're going to include, I don't know, the story of the naughty slave who ran away and how the master got them back and something, or something like that would be so appalling to a modern listener.
Yeah.
We couldn't possibly listen to that. And a story like that, I think, and I'm Jewish, and there's a lot of stories with anti-Semitism in them, in a large or a small way. As a woman, I'm hearing a lot of, as you alluded to, a lot of stories where women are very passive or they get rewarded for just being very obedient.
Yeah.
And all those things are quite difficult. And the question is, are you just going to change it? Just change it. Just go, okay, I'm just going to leave that bit out and I'm going to change the woman. So instead of saying this, she does that. And I think that we have to be very, very careful as storytellers when we tread on traditional material. However, I think what I try and do is I try and make small but significant changes. And I also try and select my stories very carefully because there is actually lots of traditional folk tales, myths and legends out there which do not have this kind of these bad messages in them or bad ideas in them. So firstly, it's about selecting. And then secondly, if you really have to tell something, then it's about choosing your viewpoint. You know, perhaps instead of telling the story from the viewpoint of the landowner, you can tell it from the viewpoint of, the youngest little sister or something like that. And that will change things. And so, I mean, but some things are just so shocking in stories. I do wonder whether those stories really ought to even be told, and maybe they should just stay in books as a kind of reference so we can look back and see the awful things that we thought. Sometimes I do think that.
Right. Bundy, how do you feel about that?
Well, yes, similarly, we are, I mean, you could say we're in a position of power. I like to think that we have a certain amount of freedom because we're in control of how we tell the story. And
yeah, Bundy, you're cutting out again.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great, okay. Yes, I'd like to say that when we are, I mean, I deal a lot with tell a lot of traditional stories, a lot of traditional material, but some of the stories are just not appropriate for society today. And some of the messaging, in particular, as you mentioned, some of the fairy tales maybe, or even folk tales, I don't want to promote those messages to some of the children today about a young girl always needs to be rescued. So what I will do is I will tell the traditional story. I will respect the storyline, the structure. But as Vanessa mentioned, I might make some very small but significant changes, perhaps giving a voice to the women or making the female a heroine or giving the old woman a name, you know, giving them giving them a voice, giving them a character. So I'm not necessarily changing what we perhaps need to learn from the story, because these stories have stood the test of time, and there is a reason that they're still here. But I do deliberately think about which story I'm going to choose to tell, not include mm-hmm. stereotypes, and if there are archetypes in there, I make it so that it's going to be relevant and adapt it for whoever is listening today, our next generation of storytellers.
Right. Yeah. How do you feel about the saying that unless the tiger gets a scribe or learns to write, history will always glorify the hunter? Wendy?
It definitely depends on who is telling the story and the perspective that you're telling it from. And it's one of the reasons why I became a storyteller. I felt very much that, in particular, some of the African and Caribbean stories that I tell, I wanted to make them accessible for people, more right. accessible for children, and also to bring my experience and my heritage, my culture to it, so that it isn't just perhaps one particular European colonial view that some of these stories might have just been have come down from, or maybe that people might not have been able to get hold of. So yes, I do help think that holds a lot of weight, that saying.
Vanessa?
Yes, I think that that quotation is so true, and I think that people are continually forgetting quite how true it is. So I quite often get asked to tell stories from history.
Yeah.
And when you start the process of getting a story ready to tell, you look at what happened, and what you will usually find is that the story is told from the perspective of whoever was the powerful, usually man, at the yeah. time. So it's normally from the king's perspective, it's normally from the lord's perspective. These stories yeah. from history. So, for example, I said that I had to work on the Great Fire of London story. Now, yeah. the story of the Great Fire of London comes to us from the diary of Samuel Pepys. Samuel Pepys was a wealthy, titled man. Yeah. So he was highborn, and he wrote a diary about all of his comings and goings in London in the 1660s. And what that meant was that the stories of poor people were simply not included. And so when I came to revise that story, I wanted to do a brand new story about the Great Fire of London. Right. I ended up telling the story of a woman who was a widow and had taken over her husband's shoe mending job. Yep. And then she lost her premises during the Great Fire, and she had to escape. She lost everything. And she ended up making and selling gingerbread to school children. And I love that because, for a start, she's a woman, and for a second, she would have been a voiceless person. She was uncovered by a historian just from certain records, court records and things like that, from some court cases that she was involved with and things like that. And it felt great to take the story of the Great Fire of London away from Samuel Pepys, who's had it for a very long time, and yeah. give it to a poor woman who had no title and no land and no money.
Yeah, absolutely. Just because you've mentioned this, of all of the different research and stuff that you've had to do, what's been the most interesting find or an unexpected find, Vanessa?
Oh my gosh.
Just the way I'm thinking here, you have been exposed to things that probably a huge portion of the world has not seen or does not know. So what's yes. been the most shocking?
Well, I did a series of educational stories with UCL. UCL University, and it was their clinical education department. So they basically study doctors' education and medical school education.
Right.
And they were doing an outreach, and they wanted stories that were about issues to do with women's sexual health. So it sounds rather specific, and it was rather specific. These were really big events. We had lots and lots of people. And what they wanted was a fairy tale which would encapsulate some of the contradictions around issues like abortion, how you treat breast cancer, and female genital mutilation. And all these very much affect women's sexual health. And so what I did as part of this project, which lasted for several years, I interviewed women who had breast cancer and their surgeons, and I talked about all their different experiences. I spoke to people who perform abortions and who've had abortions, and found out all their different experiences. And I talked to women who survive female genital mutilation, and also people, I actually managed to find somebody who thought that female genital mutilation was actually part of a good thing, an important part of culture, and I also spoke to that person. And it was absolutely eye-opening. I have never dreamed I would be talking to people about such incredibly personal things. And once you kind of get, I spent hours and hours of interviewing, of hearing these people's stories. And really, I had to listen very carefully because it was so important I did justice to these stories in my presentation. And I think perhaps the thing that has stayed with me the most was a woman telling me about her experience of female genital mutilation, which I will simply never forget. In fact, I'm starting to feel quite emotional just thinking about it. So it was such a privilege, such an unbelievable privilege to share people's lives in that way.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Vanessa. Mm. Wendy, what's been your experience?
I think most recently, I was researching and collecting stories of people who came to the UK from the Caribbean islands during the Windrush years. And I was collecting and listening to their first-hand impressions of England when they arrived as children. And there are lots of stories that are told and documented about the adults who came, including my family, and I was actually hearing stories about how people felt when they came here from between the ages of say 8 and 18, and how they felt. And rather than just focusing on what I was expecting to hear about how their parents worked and their experience finding work in the UK, but it was actually hearing stories of how they felt leaving. Being separated from their parents, first of all, who came to England first, and they were left behind for 1 or 2 years, and then coming over to join their families, and not families didn't come all together, and that separation, which sometimes for some people they hadn't talked about since they'd done it, it was quite moving, really cathartic for people that are now in their 70s and 80s. Telling me personally what they left behind, how they started again, how it wasn't the done thing in families at that time to talk about those feelings, to talk about the separation. You just had to, you know, get on with it. We're here, and this is your new life, this is your new school, and this is more a new culture that you are being introduced to. And so collecting those stories, as Vanessa said as well, I was very, very careful to make sure that I got the right account and got the right perspective, because sometimes even when you're listening you can just hear something differently from what
trying to tell you.
So that's the first time that I think I experienced that, and how important it was to take something as precious as a memory and a story like that and retell it.
Yeah, you're creating a part of history, aren't you? You're leaving a record behind for someone else to find. So an incredibly responsible job there. Wow. So many different facets to the job of professional storytelling. I am completely fascinated. We did say that we would come back to both of you for stories. So Wendy, if you would like to start with a story, I am all ears. And we have a lot of listeners who are very, very eager to.
Thank you. I wonder what mood our listeners are in for. Are they in for a scary story, a funny story?
Scary story.
I'll leave that to you.
Well, it is Friday night, ladies. It is Friday night.
It is Friday night. Okay. Well, I'm going to tell a story from Trinidad. And it's called You Reap What You Sow.
Mm-hmm.
In a small wooden house on the edge of a forest lived a family of three. There was Anil and his wife, Reshmi, and his elderly father. And times were hard back then on this island. He spent his days bent over crooked in the sugarcane field, where the ground had to be dug and hoed and weeded. And this was all under the watchful eye of the blazing sun. And she worked in the sugar mill, sifting and crushing until her dark fingers were raw with pain. Or towards the end of the day, when it had stretched into the night, they would return to their home and their work was carried on. She picked up the broom and swept the dust that had made its way into the home out into the backyard. She settled down into her small kitchen with its tiny sink under the window, with a little oven in the corner and a wooden table in the center. And there she would mash up chickpeas to make dal puri or roti for their dinner. And once, while she was rolling out the dough, she could hear her father-in-law complaining in the next room. "When are we going to eat? I'm hungry. What's taking so long?" And freshly, she tried to tune him out, muttering to herself. "Anil promised me a better life here, a nice house, more freedom. I am so free, I chose slavery." And in a way, she was right, because many like her had been indentured from India. They'd left their rural villages to sail all the way to the Caribbean. They were promised a home. They were promised good food in return for 5 years' labor. But labor without pay grants you very little freedom. And so here she was, muttering in her kitchen. Her words were bitter, like the bark of a morbid tree. And these dark thoughts twisted through her young mind. She served out every meal and tried to make them stretch for 3 mouths. "Is this all there is?" her father-in-law would grumble. They'd just sit, eating, in silence. Well, that night, Reshmi approached her husband. "Can't you put your father somewhere? He's such a burden, another mouth to feed. He complains all night, and he helps with nothing." And her husband just hung his head low, listening in silence. "He's old, Reshmi. Be patient. He's not long for this earth." He knew that his father wasn't an easy man, but he also knew that he didn't have long before he probably passed away. But each new day just brought the same harsh words from his wife. "Why can't you just leave him somewhere? Ease our pain a little." Well, finally, Anil's spirits were just worn down, and he felt moved. So one afternoon, he left the plantain and returned home early to his father. He carefully picked him up out of his chair and carried him into the forest, offering to take him for a walk. And his father, his arms were frail, and they just hung loosely around his son's neck. He'd not been further than their front yard for ages. And he just breathed in the scent of the flowers. There were white lady slipper orchids. And he just went wild when he saw chinette fruit hanging from the tree. "Please, please, let's stop for a minute, son. Grab a few for me to eat." So Anil placed his father down under the tree. And they just began shelling out some of the lime green fruit. They sat eating quietly together, just sharing this moment. You know, a waterfall in the distance and hummingbirds darting between the trees. And after a while, his father wondered why they were still there. "Surely we should go home soon now. The darkness is going to be coming." Still they sat. Anil hung his head heavy, listening to the bats soaring all around him. And finally, picked his father up from under the tree. Instead of turning to go back home the way they'd come, he walked toward the deafening sound of the water. and at the edge of the muddy bank, he stood holding his father's frail body and plunged it into the river. The murderous current just slipped away. Well, the years rolled by, and Anil and his wife had a son whose life filled them with lots of joy, more than they could ever imagine. But Reshmi passed away, leaving Anil to grow old with his son and his son's wife. She was the new daughter in their life. And this woman, she fetched and carried and cooked and cleaned, just like his wife had done before. And his father grew old and weak. But his mouth was still strong. Daughter, I need some cool water to drink. Daughter, I'm hot. Please move me. Daughter, I'm hungry. When are you going to feed me? She sighed heavily with each request that piled high. She picked up her broom. She swept the rooms. And her face soon turned sour when food became scarce. She turned to Anil's son, her husband. Your father is a burden, another mouth to feed. Can't you put him somewhere and just ease our pain for a little? Her face was twisted and tore, urging him every day. Until one morning, before the sun had risen high in the east, Anil's son picked him up and carried him for a rare walk into the forest. He hung his arms loosely around his son's shoulders, just as his father had done all those years before. They sat by the river, eating fresh tamarind from the tree, cracking open the pods and eating the sour fruit, chewing the flesh. It was so satisfying, just the two of them. But then before long, the daylight disappeared. The owls hooted in the distance, filling the sight with terror. And Anna was reminded of this very same moment when he was there in the forest with his son and father. He shook his head and said, "Don't feel bad. I know that you planned to drown me in the river, and I understand why and what it is I deserve. I've loved being your father, and I cherish you and wish you a happy life." His eyes just filled with tears, and at that moment, his son felt the true horror of what he was about to do. He just jumped out of himself, shook his head, and apologized. "I don't know what I was thinking," he said. He hid his face in shame. In the darkness, he gently picked up his father and carried him in his arms and carried him home. And when they arrived, his wife was sitting on the veranda. She sighed with disappointment seeing them both return. But he turned to his wife and just said, "My father is the reason I exist, and I owe him my life. I cannot take his life from him." She was stunned by his words, but she couldn't disagree. And instead of sowing seeds of pain and regret, they just found a way to carve out their happiness and their
wow.
Oh, wow.
Wendy, that was emotional. I have to say, Wendy, that that ending was absolutely unexpected. I was going for a Karma Gets Back to You kind of a story. Thank you for that. That was quite a good twist. Wow. Thank you, Wendy. Vanessa.
Hello. My gosh, how can I follow that wonderful story? Gosh, I love Wendy's stories so much. I think I'm not going to tell you a whole story. Instead, I'm just going to give you a little extract of one of my favorite ever stories. I'm just going to give you the very, very beginning.
Right.
So this is a Victorian story, so it's quite an old story. And it starts off with a mirror. So if you are listening to this story in your house, is there a mirror anywhere that you can see right now? If you can't see one, just think of the mirror that's nearest to you. So there are all kinds of mirrors in the world. And sometimes looking in them is a happy experience and sometimes it isn't. But this particular mirror, I would never ever show it to you, Krishna, or any of you listeners, because the mirror in this story was cursed. It was such an awful mirror. It was made by the most evil demon in the whole of history. It was a magic mirror. And when you looked into it, you could only see the ugly, bad, boring, sad, and cruel things in the world. So if you had just like a tiny little spot on your chin or something like that, and you looked in this mirror, all you'd see was what a huge, ugly, dripping globule you had on your chin, and you'd go, oh, what's that? Or if you had the mirror out with you and you were looking in it, let's say you were looking at a reflection of children playing in a playground, all you'd be able to see would be how sad they were, how cruel they were being to each other, how they were teasing and bullying each other. And the demon thought this was the most hilarious thing ever. The demon took the mirror around the world, putting it in different settings, in different people's houses, and laughing at how sad it made people. Then one of the demon's friends thought that it would be a good idea to take the mirror up to heaven to show God and all of the angels. And so together, they took hold of this enchanted mirror and started flying up with it towards heaven. And the closer they got to heaven, a very strange thing started to happen to the mirror. So I don't know if you know when an opera singer sings and you've got a wine glass, sometimes the opera singer can hit just the right note and the wine glass will start to shiver. And then, well, what happened was, as these demons got the mirror closer and closer to heaven, it started to shiver and shake. And then, just as they reached the gates of heaven, it exploded into 100,000 tiny, minute pieces. And this was the worst thing that could have possibly happened, because all of those pieces rained down on the earth. And sometimes someone would get a tiny grain of that mirror in their eye, and it would be so tiny they wouldn't even feel it. But then they would only be able to see ugly, sad, boring, and cruel things. And sometimes someone would get a piece of that mirror in their heart, and then their heart would freeze into a block of ice. So that's the beginning of the story that I wanted to tell you, but I want to just let you know that that story, this is like the beginning of the story of the Snow Queen, and it's all about two best friends, and one of them gets a piece of that mirror in his eye and another piece in his heart, and he gets kidnapped by the Snow Queen. And his best friend, who's a girl called Gerda, goes on all kinds of unbelievable adventures to try and rescue him. And when she finally finds him, there's a beautiful scene at the end where she finally finds him in the palace of the Snow Queen, and he's all frozen and he's all sad. And she comes to rescue him, but when she turns up, he doesn't want to see her because he just looks at her and goes, oh, it's you. Oh, you're following me around. I'm so bored of you. Why didn't you leave me alone? And she's so hurt by what he says that she starts to cry. And one of her tears falls onto his face and washes out the piece of mirror that was in his eye, and another one falls onto his heart and melts the ice, and they end up living happily ever after. So it's a really beautiful and uplifting ending.
That was absolutely wonderful. You had me there the whole time, Vanessa. Right, wow, completely, oops. All right, I've always wanted to press those buttons.
I love a tour. Right, so
thank you, Wendy, and thank you, Vanessa. Two very, very different stories. We can clearly see the different styles of storytelling there. Both of you come from completely different places, and I strongly believe you bring a bit of yourself into it, don't you? So it's not just about a job that you're trying to do. You're also bringing in your personality into the stories. Do you feel like self-knowledge is the root of all great storytelling?
Ooh, wow. I would say that the point of stories is to help us understand ourselves. And so it's not about me understanding myself. It's about us as a community, as story listeners and storytellers together, which is a communal experience, as Wendy already said. It's about us moving to a place of greater knowledge of ourselves.
Yeah, and yourself?
That's a wonderful way to put it.
Okay. So the more you appreciate the humanity of others and your own humanity, the more you're able to connect, is it?
Yes, and move forward, you know, in greater, hopefully greater understanding. So, yes, it's leading towards hopefully more knowledge of oneself and others.
Right. Yeah. We have just crossed over our time. It is 1:31. So we've been on air for about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I have to say, I just about saw the time. I have to say, this has been one of the best radio shows that I've had the opportunity of doing. You've both had me completely for the past hour and a half, past 90 minutes. Thank you so much. And I would like to end on something that I saw Vanessa do with one of her school visits, and she goes something like this. Now it's time to say goodbye, say goodbye, say goodbye. Hopefully that was as good a job as you did, Vanessa. Hello?
Oh, has she gone? Maybe she's dropped out for a bit. That sounded very good, I thought.
Vanessa, you there? Oh, I think she's dropped out. Never mind. Thank you so much, Wendy.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking forward to your book releasing. I know that it's available for pre-ordering at the moment.
Well, it's actually now out. You can get it in the shops, the copy of African and Caribbean Folk Tales, Myths and Legends. It came out 2 weeks ago.
Amazing. Perfect. So definitely looking forward to that. And I wish you all the very best in all of your future storytelling adventures. It's been an absolute pleasure having you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone joining us.
Vanessa, I'm not sure if you're back. It still says you're connected. Hopefully you can hear me, even though you can't respond. It's been an absolute honor listening to you, Vanessa. Thank you so much. You've inspired me to go out and research a lot of the stories that I've been exposed to. And, I hope we get a chance to talk about this in the future. Thank you so, so, so much. I wish you were able to communicate now, just for a final goodbye. But I don't think it's possible. I think you've logged out. Anyway, that's all we have time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to Teacher Talks Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Please remember, you can listen back to all of the episodes and all of the chat shows on the Teacher Talk Radio website. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful night.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.